morning walk. 9:30 p.m. He's in his kennel for the night. I was very impressed with Mr. President and Crystal for their consistent work during my absence. Remember, this is a 3.5-month-old puppy that adapted right away to a brand new situation. By your sharing only calm, assertive energy and a positive outlook, your puppy, like Mr. President, will be able to tune into his natural instincts and learn the lessons of housebreaking smoothly. Keeping your puppy in the confined space or crate in which she's assigned to stay during the times when you are unable to supervise her is also a huge boon to pain-free housebreaking. What I try to get through to people, says breeder and trainer Diana Foster, is that it's all about prevention. If you don't give them a chance to pee on the carpet, they'll never even know what peeing on the carpet is. And if you keep that up the first few months, little by little you can start to give them more freedom. When our puppies leave our kennel, none of them ever had an accident in the house. We didn't do anything to them. We didn't scold them or correct them. We just never gave them a chance to make a mistake. Baby Gates. Angel was only 8 weeks old when I adopted him, and had only just begun his housebreaking experience when I brought him home from Brooks. During the miniature schnauzer's first days at my home, he was a little more hyper and therefore more difficult to housebreak than the laid-back Mr. President. Although he was always responsive and attentive to the behavioral cues I sent him, the new environment and all the new friends to play with were perhaps a little too much stimulation all at once for the little guy. He was especially attracted to Jack, the 4-year-old Jack Russell Terrier in my pack. Having just left his own extended family of miniature schnauzers at Brooks, Angel immediately recognized and was interested in a fellow terrier. But unfortunately, Jack is a bit too hyperactive to be an ideal role model for calm, submissive behavior. All these distractions made the normally medium-level energy Angel a little more excitable in the early days, and therefore a little less consistent with his bodily functions at first, even though he had the other dog's bathroom behaviors to emulate. In addition to feeding and exercising the puppies on a regular schedule, setting up a line of baby gates in the garage, pointing a clear path to the backyard, was a great help in teaching Angel to go outside to pee and poop. This tool has been invaluable for me in keeping so many dogs in my house, garage, and yard. When using baby gates, it's important to understand that puppies don't necessarily see them as boundaries. They can be pushed over or jumped over, unless you teach them that they are boundaries. Communicating limits. With Angel, I set up the gates, then stood on the other side of them and waited for him to try to follow me. I used my body language, stepping forward strongly, putting out my hand, and most important, projecting a blocking energy to communicate to the puppy that he should not cross the threshold of the gates. When he tried to nudge the gate in order to push it over, I moved toward him even more assertively, establishing an invisible frontier between him and the gates on both sides. With this motion and this energy, I am clearly communicating to him that he is not allowed to get too close to the gate, even on his side. I repeated this exercise several times, even though Angel is an amazingly quick study, and I continued to reinforce it again over the next several days. Within 3 days, Angel totally respected my concept of a borderline that he could not cross. Dogs naturally respect invisible boundaries, much more so than man-made ones. They set invisible limitations for one another all the time by using energy and body language. But you must take the time and patience to reinforce the rules until your puppy internalizes them. Role models. One of the best ways to teach a puppy about proper bathroom etiquette is to let an older dog lead by example. When Junior first arrived at our home, he immediately learned the good habits of the smaller dogs living at our home back then, Coco the Chihuahua, Molly the Dachshund, Sid the French Bulldog, and Minnie the Chihuahua Terrier mix. That's also how he learned to use wee-wee pads right away. A big help to me, for when I wanted to bring my handsome new pit bull on the road with me and the Dog Whisperer crew. When Blizzard came along, Junior was able to impart his good manners to the new little yellow lab puppy in the family, who in turn was able to influence Angel and Mr. President, both of whom were perfectly housebroken within a couple of weeks. That's a beautiful thing. Generation after generation of dogs, all teaching one another to be balanced. Wee-wee pads. Many puppy owners, particularly puppy owners who live in cities, don't want to go through the chore of taking a puppy outdoors 5 or 6 times a day, so they choose to use wee-wee pads as a shortcut to housebreaking their dog. The wee-wee pads are a wonderful invention, and my dogs use them all the time when we travel. It's very important that puppies learn to eliminate outdoors as well as behind walls. Your home becomes a big den to your dog, and it's not natural for them to eliminate inside the confines of their own personal nesting space. Conditioning a dog to eliminate only inside the house goes against your puppy's inborn nature. That's why puppy mill puppies like Georgia Peaches continue to have accidents throughout their lifespan. Often, when people start by conditioning puppies to depend on wee-wee pads alone, they are shocked when the dog won't eliminate outdoors. The truth is, you, the owner, have created the situation by stifling the puppy's own natural instinct not to eliminate where he lives. The best way to incorporate wee-wee pads into your housebreaking routine is to set them out only at times when you won't be able to supervise. Set out 4 pads at first, in order to zero in on exactly the part of the pad where the puppy will relieve himself. As the puppy begins to use them correctly, and to refine and mature his behavior, you can remove the pads until there is only 1 left, at exactly the spot where he will go every time. In order to attract the puppy to the pad, find a piece of grass or dirt with the scent of urine or feces from another dog on it and place it on the pad. This may sound distasteful to you, but the presence of another dog's excrement will stimulate your puppy's brain to pee right over it. Eventually, you won't need to do this once the puppy is conditioned to the pads. In the area of my house or hotel room where I keep the wee-wee pads, I always use an air filter to make sure the scent doesn't travel, and I make sure to give the dogs a place to sleep that is far away from the pads, since dogs, like humans, like their bedroom and their bathroom to be in distinct locations. As soon as I get up, I roll up the used pads and immediately mop up the floor beneath the pads so there is no more scent. This is a must for using pads, newspapers, or anything you put on the floor for the puppy to relieve himself on. Always replace the used pad immediately and clean up the floor underneath, because a dog doesn't want to pee on a place where he himself has already peed. In addition to helping train your puppy to use that spot again, you will be keeping your own environment clean and sanitary. Don't take it personally. Housebreaking is not rocket science, but if an accident does happen, it's important not to get upset or frustrated. A dog isn't wetting on the floor to hurt your feelings, to get even with you, or because he's angry at you. Nor is he telling you that all your previous housebreaking efforts are failing and that you have to go all the way back to step one. Early on, accidents are a part of the process, and the only correct response from you is patience. Repeatedly making a big deal out of a housebreaking mishap is one of the worst things you can do, because you will be teaching your puppy that if he pees, he can produce a certain response in you. No matter how young or how old your dog is, he is always reading your emotional state and energy, and constantly updating himself about exactly what makes you tick. When your puppy does something that triggers a negative emotion in you, It makes you weak in his eyes. So the puppy learns, hey, this is an easy way to control this human. Later, if the puppy is bored or lonely or has nothing else to do, he can just pee, and you'll provide him with a little gratuitous entertainment. Just like kids, dogs will sometimes choose negative attention over no attention at all. And never, ever correct or punish. Don't buy into the old-school notion that you should push a puppy's nose into his excrement or hit him if he happens to go in the house. This makes absolutely no sense to him. Instead, remain calm and assertive, and immediately bring the puppy outside to where he is supposed to relieve himself, or to the puppy pad if that's the only option at the time. If you catch a puppy in the act, use a light touch or a sound simply to distract or snap him out of it, then remove him to his spot outside and wait until he relaxes and finishes his business. You are using the opportunity of your puppy's making a mistake as a chance to reinforce the behavior that you do want from him. That way, you are telling the puppy, it doesn't matter what you do. In every situation, I will always have the right answer, and I will always share a calm energy. That kind of neutral but reliable response is the nature of true leadership. Done correctly, housebreaking should not be a turbulent production, but just a matter of putting a little extra work into getting your puppy on a schedule during the first few weeks after he arrives at your home. Don't let unnecessary stress over this very natural, uncomplicated process taint any of the joy surrounding your new dog's puppyhood. Do's and don'ts of housebreaking. 1. Do bring the puppy outside first thing in the morning, immediately after eating each meal, after he awakens from a nap, and after long play sessions. 2. Do bring the puppy to the same general area outdoors each time. 3. Do supervise your puppy closely. You are investing a lot of time in these first months to establish a lifetime of good behaviors. Keep your puppy with you as much as possible. If you can't be with him, put him in a safe and closed area or in his crate. If you think you might forget about your puppy's call of nature, set a timer to remind yourself. 4. Do remain consistent. Daily consistency is the key to good habits. Feed and walk your puppy at around the same time every day. Remember, dogs don't understand the concept of weekends or holidays. If you want to sleep late on a Sunday, take your puppy out first, then go back to bed. 5. Don't punish a puppy for an accident or do anything to create a negative association with his bodily functions. Stay calm and assertive and quietly remove the puppy to the place where you want him to go. 6. Don't potty train a puppy on wee-wee pads alone. It's not natural for a dog to relieve himself inside his den. Make sure you alternate between outdoor and indoor bathroom habits. Setting rules, boundaries, and limitations. Many owners will be all too tempted to shower their puppy or new dog with toys, petting, and nonstop attention, to give her table scraps or treats whenever she begs, and to give her the run of the house right away. To our human minds, this is what we do to show a dog that we love her. The problem is, your new puppy is coming directly from her first family, her mother and litter mates, where love equaled order and organization. If she was also raised by a conscientious breeder, she has probably already begun to learn and internalize her very first set of human regulations. The dog already knows it needs to live with rules and boundaries, as this is all it has known since birth, Diana Foster explains. This dog is very content, secure, and conditioned to living with certain rules and restrictions. Now, this same dog that equated leadership with her mother's and breeder's calm, assertive energy suddenly finds herself surrounded by unstable, excited energy, and humans who either don't set any limits or are mostly inconsistent with the ones they do set. The dog, formerly just one member of a cohesive, well-behaved pack, suddenly sees that all the focus, all the attention, is on her, except when she's expected to be alone. In the brochure that she gives out when a new owner purchases one of her Thin Schmidt German Shepherds, Diana Foster describes the likely outcome of this situation. The dog enters a new home, and this family hugs him, pets him, and talks to him without him having to do anything to earn it. He is given lots of attention and is barely alone for even a few minutes. Later, it is time for bed, and the family finally puts the puppy in his crate for the night. So now he has gone from almost nonstop attention to absolute isolation. This is too much of an extreme for any dog and causes total stress and anxiety. Now you have a puppy who is barking and whining in his crate. Why? He has already made the association that being in your house means freedom to walk around freely and having people with him. Where are all the people? Where is all the attention? The pup wants more of what he had earlier. You have just set yourself up, and you need to ask if it was worth it. By introducing your puppy to your home on your terms, by crate training early, and by restricting her territory to a safe, limited area for her first weeks or months at home, you are creating the rules, boundaries, and limitations that will provide the framework for her secure, happy future. Expressing disagreement. Puppies are hungry for direction and are receptive to any limits you might want to set. But how do you express those limits kindly, fairly, and in a language the puppy will understand? A mother dog does not bribe with treats or petting to get good behavior, although she does sometimes reward submissive behavior after the fact with licking and grooming. She does not whine or cajole with her voice. She corrects the behavior of her offspring using calm, assertive energy, body language, eye contact, and touch. The pups always understand exactly what she wants, and she rarely has to correct the same blunder more than once. On the other hand, most humans correct a puppy using frustrated, anxious, or angry energy, jerky movements, such as pulling a hand or an object away, or moving their bodies away, and loud sounds. No, stop it, bad dog. You'll hear such humans repeating their admonishments over and over and over again. Then they throw up their hands in amazement that their puppy doesn't obey them. I believe we can help our dogs understand us better by trying to speak with them in their own language. That means I will address an unwanted behavior in a more canine style, using one or a combination of techniques I refer to as corrections. 1. By using my energy and intention to communicate that I don't agree with a behavior, while never taking the dog's actions personally, and always remaining calm and unruffled, what I call calm, assertive energy. 2. By using eye contact to communicate my energy and intention. 3. By using my body and body language to own my space and to block an unwanted behavior. For instance, stepping forward purposefully into a puppy's space to own it, or firmly nudging away a puppy that is trying to climb on my leg. 4. By using touch to communicate displeasure or snap a dog out of an escalating behavior. Touch never ever means hit. Puppies and most dogs are very responsive to touch at the level of the kind of light tap you might use to get a friend's attention in a darkened movie theater. Touch a puppy on the side of its neck or on the side of its hindquarters. Use a claw-shaped hand, which mimics a mother's bite, on the side of the neck, on the muscle, not the throat. This hand doesn't pinch. It is firm, but it doesn't have to use much pressure. The pressure should be proportionate to the level of behavior. For instance, an adult dog that has escalated into a red zone will need more pressure than a puppy that has just begun chewing a shoe, which will need only a light touch. All dogs recognize this sensation from their early puppyhood and respond in a primal way. The timing of a touch correction is crucial. It has to take place at the exact moment of the transgression and end the moment the puppy relaxes and changes her behavior. Waiting until after the behavior is over doesn't make sense to a dog, because dogs live in the moment. Cause and effect have to match in their minds. One firm touch is effective. Half a dozen small pushes, pinches, or tweaks can make the situation worse. A mother dog or other adult dog will also sometimes emit a low growl from time to time, using sound to convey disagreement with a pup's behavior. All it takes is the hint of a growl from Daddy to send Junior, Blizzard, Angel, and Mr. President into daddy-pleasing mode. He commands that much respect from all his adopted grandkids. As an adolescent, Junior has learned to mimic this growl, and that's how he keeps the younger puppies respectful of his role as a big brother. Taking a page from this section of the Canine Dictionary, I advise clients to create a simple sound their dog will associate with the thought, "I don't agree with that behavior." Choose another sound that means, "Yes, come," or "I like that behavior." I use the "tss" sound to represent displeasure. I use a kissing sound to represent a positive action or a call to follow or pay attention to me. The specific sound you choose doesn't matter at all. There's no magic to the sound "tss." It's the calm, assertive energy and the intention behind the sound that carry the communication. Just make sure you use the same simple sound every time. Timing of the sound is essential. It's best to use it early in the escalation of an unwanted behavior. With a positive sound, don't repeat the sound unless your dog is already giving you the positive behavior that you desire. This way, the sound reinforces the action. Don't use a dog's name to correct her. Like the positive sound, use her name only when she is giving you a positive response. There is one more way dogs correct one another, and that is by ignoring. If an unwanted behavior remains at a fairly low level of escalation, especially if the behavior is designed to gain attention, ignoring can be just as effective as a touch or sound correction. A puppy's litter mate may turn and ignore her if she starts to play too roughly. If the first puppy still wants to play, she's got to figure out a more appropriate way of getting the other puppy to give her what she wants. In much the same way, blocking and then turning away and ignoring a puppy that jumps up on you when you come through the door can be effective, if the intensity of the jumping isn't too high yet. The action you take to correct a behavior should always be proportionate in intensity to the level of the behavior that prompted it. The great thing about puppies is that if you supervise them closely in the beginning, you need never let any unwanted behavior escalate to the point where much correction is needed. Redirecting and rewarding. It's simple enough to block or correct a dog or puppy when she is making a basic mistake, but that only stops the behavior. It doesn't change it. In most situations, we also have to offer an alternative behavior. For instance, if a dog is play biting, a claw hand to the neck can correct the behavior, but a chew toy redirects it. If a dog is trying to jump onto something, we can physically step in between and block the behavior. But if we insist that the dog sit after she has submitted, we have redirected the energy and provided an alternative solution. Once a puppy has agreed to do it our way, we can reward and reinforce with petting, or a treat, or a toy, the way a mother dog sometimes rewards with licking and grooming. Reinforcing with something pleasant is a good strategy, but the reward or affection won't be effective unless it's offered after the behavior has changed and the dog is in the ideal calm, submissive state of mind. Affection should always come after exercise and discipline. I'll talk more in Chapter 7 about how to use rewards to communicate with a dog and help condition her behavior. Enforcing the rules. These are the basic skills everyone in the family needs to master in order to manage a puppy's behavior. 1. Have a picture in your mind of the behavior you desire. 2. Clearly and consistently communicate that desired behavior. In this communication, energy, intention, and body language are more important and more easily comprehended by your puppy than verbal commands. 3. Ignore very mild misbehaviors using the no-touch, no-talk, no-eye-contact rule. They usually correct themselves when they aren't reinforced. 4. Immediately and consistently give corrections to more obvious misbehaviors. 5. Always apply corrections with calm, assertive energy. Never take your puppy's misbehavior personally. 6. Always give your puppy an alternative, acceptable behavior every time you correct an unwanted one. 7. Reward good behaviors with affection, treats, praise, or simply your silent joy and approval, which your puppy immediately senses and understands. Whatever rules, boundaries, and limitations you desire on setting for your dog, they have to be enforced from the moment the puppy enters your home for the first time, and they have to be reinforced consistently by all pack leaders in the family. Your dog needs to know where she stands from the very start, how the routine is going to flow, and what is and isn't acceptable with her new pack. By being clear about those rules from day one, you set her up to succeed as a member of her new pack, which is what you want for her and what she really wants for herself. Preventing separation anxiety. The skills you've mastered in communicating limits to your puppy or new dog will never come in more handy than when you are tackling this very important issue that occurs in every dog's life. Separation anxiety. The leash, the rollover, the sit, getting your slippers, whatever behaviors you wish your dog to learn in the future, are all a piece of cake for her compared to being left on her own. This is a very common problem and is to be expected. Dogs are not programmed to live by themselves. In nature, the constant presence of the pack is what shapes their identities. The only time they have to learn to be alone is when they live among humans. We shouldn't be surprised that they are distressed by it. But even though we are asking them to do something unnatural, we can't feel bad about it or stress out about it, because this is the reality of how we live today. Our modern lives make it next to impossible that our dogs are with us 24/7. But there's a reason dogs as a species have survived millions of years of evolution in just about every environment imaginable, in every corner of the globe. They are among the most adaptive mammals ever created. A dog, and especially a puppy, can adjust to this new style of life with very little difficulty, if we help her to do it in stages, and if we stay calm and unemotional about it. That's what we want to communicate to her, to relax. The puppies I raised for this book lived at my house and were with my pack almost constantly. But they will all eventually find loving adoptive families, and at some point in all their lives, they may have to spend time alone. Even Junior, who will always be my dog, will travel with me, and like Daddy before him, may end up spending hours alone in a hotel room while I go to a business meeting or a restaurant. I owe it to all these puppies to begin taking certain steps from day one, in order for them to always feel comfortable being alone and behind walls when I am gone. Of all the puppies in this book, Angel had the hardest time with separation anxiety. I first noticed that if he was outside in the backyard and the rest of the dogs had wandered back into the house without his noticing, he would look into the window, whine, and bark. Sometimes he'd jump up and scratch at the sliding glass door on the screen. When Melissa took Angel for his little adventure away from home, the only time he whined at all was when she took his crate down to the car, right before he was to come home to me. She left him in the apartment with her husband John for a few minutes, and right after she left with the crate, he started to cry and run from window to window, trying to find her. John made the typical human mistake. He went to Angel and started cooing, "It's okay, it's okay." When a human does this, he is essentially saying to the dog, "Your separation anxiety is okay. I agree with how you were reacting." You are reinforcing the behavior you want to change, and you are not offering leadership, which is the very thing that anxious dog is seeking at that moment. Angel's behavior illustrates something important for us to understand about separation anxiety. It's in a dog's nature to try to come to get us when we leave. Dogs are programmed to want to be with the pack, to follow the pack, and to try to reunite the pack when separated. If they can't follow the pack, they'll try to call them back with their voice. Much of the time, they succeed in bringing people back this way. What's more, they bring them back upset or feeling sorry for the dog and guilty about leaving. Often the people they bring back also bring them treats, so the message they get is, "They're not here to stop my anxiety. They're here to reward my anxiety." We can't take our dog's separation anxiety personally or feel that we are doing something awful to them to make them feel this way. If they don't succeed in bringing us back, it's a logical next step for them to try to dig themselves out from behind walls if they can't find us any other way. In Marley and Me, John Grogan wrote that Marley's separation anxiety and fear during thunderstorms became so extreme that he actually made holes in the drywall, digging until his paws bled, trying to get out and find his pack again. The problem was, the Grogans let Marley's anxiety escalate to the point of no return. You don't want to wait until your neighbors are calling the apartment manager or homeowners association saying, "That dog's got to go." Instead, prepare your dog for such situations by setting up the separation in stages so it never turns into full-blown anxiety. To condition Angel out of his separation anxiety, I would practice putting the other dogs in the garage or in the house, leaving him outside alone. Then I'd hide just out of his sight. It would take him a few minutes, but eventually he would start crying. If I waited too much longer, the crying would become screaming, and I didn't want it to go that far. Instead, I would come back from my hiding place and immediately address his behavior. I stood as far away from him as possible, since eventually I want to be able to be miles away from him, and had a conversation using my tsk sound, my body language, and my energy to communicate to him. "I do not agree with your behavior. I want you to relax." One finger up means sit, and when Angel would comply, I would check his energy. At first, even though he was sitting, I saw that he was still in an alert state, yawning. Many people make the mistake of thinking yawning means a dog is relaxed, but puppies often yawn when they are anxious or frustrated by a situation they can't figure out. I could tell by Angel's anxious eye contact and his stiff body that he hadn't relaxed yet, so I stayed where I was until he went into the relaxed state I was seeking. About 30 seconds later, he moved away. I would go and hide again. The second time I left Angel alone, after a minute or two, he started pacing. Then he started darting to the side of the house. This is typical. He was trying to find a way out. That's the part of his survival programming that says, "I need to find a way to be part of my family again." This is why we have to be very patient. And this is why we have to prepare for separation in stages. In this case, I came back out, addressed Angel again, waited, then hid. Each time I tried to stand a little farther away when I addressed him. Each time I did the exercise, Angel would stay calm a little longer before he became anxious. I knew I was making progress with Angel after the third time I corrected him. After waiting several minutes and not hearing any whining, I sneaked back into the room and crept toward the window. There was my little schnauzer, stretched out on the patio, resting in the sun with his eyes closed. This was exactly what I wanted. There was no need to get all excited, and no need to reward him, because his behavior, being over his anxiety, was a reward in itself. What I do instead when I see such progress in my dogs is to silently thank God for helping me to teach them that I mean no harm when I leave. That it's not a bad thing, it's just how we live. For me, prayer increases my own relaxation, so my energy creates a more relaxing environment for my dogs and for my family. Chapter 5. Your Healthy Puppy. Healthcare Basics. This is a book about puppy behavior, not puppy biology, but when you bring any new dog home with you, you are automatically taking responsibility for every aspect of his health and welfare for the rest of his life. That's why preparation and prevention are so important. All it takes is one disease, accident, or injury to bring home the harsh reality of how very expensive caring for a sick animal can be. I've faced it myself many times over a lifetime of living with dogs. Emergency veterinary bills can easily run into the tens of thousands of dollars. Of course, once we fall in love with an animal, no amount of money is too much for us to spend to save his life or take away his pain, but we can lower the odds of having to go into debt or empty out our savings for the dog we love if we take certain precautions early on. Selecting for health. Prevention starts with the choice of how and from whom you get your puppy. Top-notch breeders like the ones who have contributed to this book keep up with the latest research about genetically transmitted defects or illnesses, and they are meticulous about selecting dogs whose parents and grandparents also have clean bills of health. German Shepherds, for instance, have a history of genetically transmitted hip problems. To prevent passing this tendency onto the puppies in their lines, Diana and Doug Foster study a comprehensive pedigree database before selecting sires and dams to mate for their Thinschmidt kennels. Diana says, "It's time-consuming, but it's really important. It shows you the line breeding, what's coming up, how many generations, the father, the grandfather, all the way back. We have to be careful not to breed too close. Then we have to study, what did both the lines, the mother and the fathers, produce in the past? If there are any issues, like the hips, for example, that's a red flag. Don't put that combination together. We breed on the much stricter German standard, where there is a numerical rating system for hip dysplasia, so that's something else we take into account. It's actually a science. We don't just put two dogs together because they both have pretty colors. And a lot of people don't know that. So when they come to us, they ask, 'Why are your puppies so expensive? I just looked at one that's half the price, and it looks just as good.' We try to explain to them what goes into creating a dog that's not only got a great temperament, but will have a long, healthy life. They don't always listen, and we'll go for the cheaper one. Sometimes it's a disaster. If you do buy your puppy from a reputable breeder, that breeder will want to stay in touch with you throughout the puppy's lifetime and be updated on any health problems that develop. Brooke Walker will even pay for a necropsy on any dogs from her lines if they pass away prematurely, to make sure there weren't any hidden health problems that may affect future generations of her prize miniature schnauzers. If you are adopting your puppy from a shelter or rescue organization, try to get as much information as possible about the puppy's parents, or at the very least, the area from which he was rescued and the general health of the animals there. Make sure the puppy has had a thorough veterinary checkup, and get all the records that exist on any procedures or vaccines he has undergone since he came to the rescue. You can't ask the puppy, "Did your mom have a tendency toward chronic eye infections?" But the more information you can gather about his past, the better armed you will be if you come up against genetically or environmentally transmitted problems in the future. If you are adopting an older dog from a shelter or rescue, a previous owner or rescuer may have put together important medical information about the dog. Make sure you don't bring your dog home without asking. Planning for veterinary costs. Keeping complete and thorough records is the first step towards safeguarding your new pet's health. The next is taking stock of your personal financial situation and planning for the long-term costs associated with owning and caring for a dog. According to the American Veterinary Medical Association, the average American spends about $350 in medical expenses per dog each year. The American Pet Product Association gives a lower amount, $211 for routine care, but adds $574 a year for surgical costs. Either way, it's a considerable sum. Most of us don't want our kids to go without health insurance because we understand the ramifications an unexpected sickness or accident can have on our family bank accounts. The same situation can occur with a pet. We are all struggling in today's difficult economy, but I strongly suggest that new dog or puppy owners create a separate savings fund for their pet that is not to be touched except in the case of animal-related medical expenses or emergencies. Of course, your dog doesn't know or care if you have a bank account in his name, but to my mind, every responsible action we take to protect a dog's quality of life only raises the level of our calm, assertive energy. When we are relaxed and confident about our ability to care for our dogs, no matter what happens, it only contributes to strengthening our roles as their unshakable pack leaders. A second option is pet health insurance. I am often asked, is pet health insurance a scam? The answer is no, if you do your research, buy from a reputable company, and have realistic expectations. In fact, many progressive employers, including Google Incorporated, Hilton Hotels Corporation, Ford Motor Company, and McDonald's Corporation, have become so impressed with the practicality of pet health insurance, they have begun to offer group policies for their workers who are pet owners. Pet health insurance is not intended for basic routine exams or vaccinations. Plan to work those into your regular household budget. The American Animal Hospital Association did a study that showed the majority of pet owners felt comfortably prepared for emergency expenses from $500 to $1,000, but had serious concerns about being able to handle anything higher than that. As a result, the AAHA has spent several years working directly with the pet insurance industry to develop smaller premium, larger deductible policies. Now that the AAHA and other organizations such as the ASPCA and Humane Society have begun to officially rate and review those corporations offering pet health insurance policies, owners no longer need worry about falling for a potential scam. For a good website comparing what different companies have to offer, check out http://www.petinsurancereview.com. Vaccinations. The first journey you will take with your puppy in terms of safeguarding his long-term health will be the experience of getting him through the vaccination process to make sure he has adequate protection against a host of common canine maladies. Puppies enter this world without any antibodies at all, meaning they have absolutely no pre-existing immunity to the many viruses and diseases that lurk in our modern world. Nature, however, has provided a natural buffer for their first few months of life. The rich, thick milk called colostrum that a mother dog secretes right after giving birth contains all her own antibodies and provides a temporary shield to protect her offspring. The amount of natural immunity a puppy retains is usually based on a pup's birth order and his inborn energy level. Since the most assertive nursers get the lion's share of this limited offer premium beverage. But the colostrum offers only a temporary protection. Every 9 days, the pup's antibody levels drop by half, until at around 4 months of age, the level is too low to protect them anymore, making them easy targets for parasites and viruses. This is why veterinarians prescribe a series of vaccinations, usually starting at around 6 to 8 weeks of age and continuing until 16 weeks, 4 months. Vaccines are spaced out over 3 to 4 week intervals for the antibodies to take effect, as well as to protect the puppy's delicate system from possible side effects. They are also staggered so that the vaccine won't cancel out the natural antibodies from the colostrum, or vice versa. Never allow a repeat or new vaccine if your puppy was vaccinated less than 14 days earlier. If you have bought your puppy from a breeder, it's likely that he will already have had at least one set of shots by the time he comes home with you, probably at least one deworming in addition to a DHPP, distemper, infectious hepatitis, parainfluenza, parvovirus, vaccination. Most veterinarians recommend the following protocol. Recommendations for puppy vaccinations. 3 weeks, worming. 6 weeks, worming for the common parasites passed through the mother's placenta and milk, fecal exam for coccidia, and combination DHPP, distemper, infectious hepatitis, parainfluenza, and parvovirus. 9 weeks, worming, DHPP. 12 weeks, possible worming, DHPP, possible rabies, leptospirosis and Lyme if in endemic area. The last two will need to be boosted in 3 weeks if given. Possible board, Bordetella, if puppy is going to be boarded or groomed frequently. 16 weeks, possible DHPP, final fecal exam, and rabies if not done previously. Dr. Paula Terrify, owner of Founders Veterinary Clinic in Brea, California, is a veterinarian educated at University of California, Davis, who describes her approach to puppy care as integrative holistic, combining modern Western medicine with non-traditional therapies, with an emphasis on preventive medicine. Having written a book entitled How to Protect Your Dog from a Vaccine Junkie, Dr. Terrify takes a different approach to the puppyhood shot routine. I'm very conservative when it comes to vaccines, she states. I think the earliest a puppy should start a vaccine series is between 8 and 9 weeks. If we're starting at 8 to 9 weeks, they should get revaccinated 3 to 4 weeks after that. The last vaccine should be given between 12 and 14 weeks old. We're talking about DHP here. Rabies is different. Rabies is at 4 months and then 1 year, so ideally puppies should receive no more than 3 series of vaccines. But I tell people to do their own research. So check with your vet or with a few vets. When it comes to the vaccination versus over-vaccination controversy, I tend to come down on the side of Mother Nature. That is, I want to do all I can to make sure my puppies have full immunity against dangerous diseases. But at the same time, I believe a tendency to over-vaccinate has greatly hurt rather than helped many generations of dogs. In my last book, A Member of the Family, I chronicle my story of meeting the many learned experts, including premier holistic veterinary pioneer Dr. Marty Goldstein, and reading the convincing studies and research, all of which led me to form this conclusion. In 2006, the American Animal Hospital Association, AAHA, came down on this side as well. AAHA released a new strategy for vaccinating your dogs, based on years of research, supporting the conclusion that over-vaccinating dogs contributes to chronic illnesses, disease, and even death. The new guidelines divided vaccinations into three categories. Core. Vaccines that should be given to every dog. Non-core. Optional vaccines that should be considered only if an individual dog's lifestyle or risk factors strongly warrant it. Not recommended. Vaccines not recommended by the AAHA under any circumstances. Core vaccines. Distemper, hepatitis, adenovirus 2, parvovirus, DHP, 3-in-1 vaccine. Rabies. Non-core vaccines. Leptospirosis. Lyme. Both may be considered on a regional basis where these diseases are known to be a true risk. Bordetella. Kennel cough. Parainfluenza. Not recommended. Adenovirus 1. Coronavirus. Giardia. Crotalus atrox toxoid. Rattlesnake. Porphyromonas, periodontal disease. Since a thorough series of vaccines given in puppyhood has now been determined to provide most of a dog's immunity for life, the AAHA recommends revaccination no more than once every 3 years. Many of my holistic veterinarian friends think that even 3 years is far too often to risk exposing your dog to the health risks of over-vaccination, since multiple studies have shown that dogs properly immunized in puppyhood maintain lifetime immunity to hepatitis, distemper, and parvovirus. A great option for conscientious dog owners is to ask their veterinarian to provide antibody titer testing for distemper, parvo, or rabies, which shows approximately how much disease-fighting immunity is present in your dog's system at the time the test is given. If your dog has plenty of antibodies, then the titer level will be high, proof that the vaccines have done their job, and your dog is protected. With a high titer level, you can assume your dog doesn't need a vaccine booster, though even a low blood titer doesn't necessarily mean another vaccine is indicated. For more information about titer testing, contact www.hemopet.org. There is a short period of about a week during which the puppy no longer has much immunity from its mother left, but the new vaccines have not fully kicked in and started working. This window can allow even the best-cared-for puppies to get sick. But the potential danger can be exaggerated to the point where dog owners will grow paranoid and keep their puppies inside and isolated for months, ultimately creating frustrated and antisocial dogs. I tell my clients that 10 days after the first vaccine, they should begin to get as much socialization for their puppy as they possibly can, advises Dr. Charlie Reinheimer of Northampton Community College. I counsel them to stay away from places like dog parks, where you have no idea of the vaccination or health status of the dogs, during that time, but going to visit friends with dogs, taking walks on a leash, or going for car rides are all great. After 16 weeks, anything goes as far as I'm concerned. Parvo. I recently had a frightening experience with the parvovirus that really shook me up. Around the time I began thinking of raising puppies to write about in this book, a friend came to me having rescued two abandoned 2-month-old Yorkie puppies from the streets. My wife and I were about to leave for a seminar on the East Coast the following day, but as usual, I could not say no to any abandoned dogs, let alone two tiny puppies. I left instructions for our housekeeper to care for the puppies while we were gone and made an appointment with Dr. Rick Garcia to come by and check them out when I came back in a few days. We hadn't even been gone a full day when our housekeeper called us in a panic. "The puppies are very, very sick," she told me. "They have really bad diarrhea and they're shaking." I called and asked a friend, Dog Whisperer field producer Todd Henderson, to go to our house to get the puppies and rush them to the vet. Todd later described to me the horrible experience of driving beyond the speed limit to get to the animal hospital while the puppies struggled to stay alive in his car. They both made it to medical care, but one of them passed away shortly after arrival. The diagnosis was the parvovirus, which meant that all the dogs staying at my home had been exposed. Fortunately, they all had full immunization, but we had to disinfect our entire home and garage with the only solution known to kill the hardy virus, 1 part chlorine bleach to 10 parts water. Before we could sleep easily again, I also had Dr. Rick give the rest of the pack a clean bill of health. This horrendous event demonstrated to me the quick and deadly power of the parvovirus, to which puppies are susceptible during their most sensitive period of development. Parvo is an extremely contagious organism that targets the sensitive intestinal lining of puppies. It can be fatal. Even if caught early, the treatment involves quarantine and is extremely expensive. I remember when parvo first struck when I was in vet school, recalls Dr. Paula Terrify. Puppies would die when we thought they'd live, and live when we were sure they'd die. It's a tough thing. Parvo is spread through the feces of infected dogs, and some adult dogs can carry the virus without showing symptoms. Dr. Paula explains, describing exactly what happened in our home with the Yorkies. With the parvovirus, puppies are most likely to be exposed before they are adopted into their new homes. Kennels, questionable breeders, animal shelters, and pet stores are all breeding grounds for viruses. The exposed puppy will not show signs of illness for 5 to 7 days, which is the incubation period. Often, a healthy-looking puppy is brought into the home and then becomes ill days later. Then people think that they were the ones who exposed the pup, but most times that's not what happened. Most of the sick puppies I see came from a pet shop or the internet, and they are almost always from puppy mills. They are shipped or come from a contaminated facility and stressful conditions. Infectious diseases run rampant in puppy mills, but not among puppies coming from respectable breeders or good shelters and rescues. Despite my recent experience with the virus, I still believe that many owners become so fearful of their puppies contracting it that they overprotect them, isolating them indoors for weeks or even months and depriving them of much-needed exercise and socialization with their own kind. In coming chapters, I'll offer more suggestions on how to safely socialize and exercise your puppy under 16 weeks of age. In the case of the Yorkie puppies, I'm happy to say that the little guy that survived received medication and went through a period of quarantine. He is now a much-loved, healthy adolescent, living in the comfortable home of a supporter of the Caesar and Illusion Milan Foundation. General Puppy Health FAQs. We generally say don't treat your puppy like a baby, but in terms of health, puppies are a little like babies. They do need a certain level of protection. They are vulnerable to the heat and cold and can dehydrate quickly. They definitely need more care and attention than adult dogs, according to Dr. Paula Terrify. However, because of the excellence of modern veterinary medicine, most of the vets I work with rarely see many sick puppies in their practices these days. We do see a few health issues, such as diarrhea from worms and upper respiratory infections such as kennel cough, says Dr. Charlie. There have been a few recent parvo outbreaks in unvaccinated puppies, especially pit bulls, a breed that seems to be more susceptible and often dies. We hardly ever see lepto, hepatitis, or thank goodness, rabies in puppies. Dr. Charlie's rural Pennsylvania practice has seen a recent rise in Lyme disease cases, also epidemic among humans in that region, but a definite drop in preventable illnesses. Actually, we don't see too many major mistakes made by owners anymore, either. People seem to be more educated on the need for a series of vaccines and heartworm prevention. Most of the mistakes we see are on the behavioral side, he says. Good nutrition, a thorough vaccination program, regular vet checkups, and a good owner-based health check and maintenance program at home serve as prevention for many